It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last week, the Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents approved a proposal to form a new College of Computing and Artificial Intelligence at UW-Madison.
It's the first time that leaders of the system's flagship campus have created a new academic division since 1983, when they opened the School of Veterinary Medicine.
Campus leaders say the move is in response to growing enrollment in computer science and related majors.
The new college will be housed in Morgridge Hall. That's a $267 million facility that opened in August.
Jennifer Mnookin joins us now, Chancellor of UW-Madison since 2022. Chancellor Mnookin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Launching a new academic division, it's a really big deal. Why make this move now?
Well, it's something that really builds on years of vision and hard work as we've been growing our strength in computer science and related disciplines. And then we've also seen that artificial intelligence is starting to touch everything, all disciplines, so many places in the workforce. And this seemed like the right moment to pull all of that together, both for a new college that will train students who might major in these disciplines, but also serve as a hub for our whole campus and, frankly, broader communities as well.
Can you talk about removing these aspects from the College of Letters and Sciences? I mean, from what I understand, this college would be the new home for the School of Computer, Data, and Information Sciences, which was started in 2019, currently part of the College of Letters and Sciences. What are the benefits of starting a whole new college rather than letting the computer science program continue to thrive where it is?
Well, it certainly is thriving where it is, and I think it will thrive in this new way as well. And I think it will also continue to have a great deal of connectivity with letters in science and all across our campus. But at scale, we now have 3,000 computer science majors. It's almost tripled since 2015. It's become our largest major. Data science is one of our fastest growing majors and has 1,700 students. Information science has about 500 students. It just started in 2022 as a major. And then we have many more students from all across our university who are taking classes in these disciplines or doing certificates, which is our word for minor. And so at this scale, it just made a lot of sense to make it a freestanding college where we can focus on meeting our student needs, our faculty needs, and also creating connectivity all across campus with letters in science, but also all of our other schools and colleges.
I want to go back to that connectivity in just a moment, but in terms of the numbers of computer science majors, computer science grads are facing the worst entry-level job market in years. Are you worried about oversaturation, about overproducing computer science majors relative to market demands?
I think that there's going to continue to be a lot of opportunity for those who study computer science, but we are seeing students interested in doing two majors, computer science and something else, so that they can combine computer science or data science with another area of substantive knowledge as well. It wouldn't surprise me if that is a growing trend, especially in a time when when AI is able to do some kinds of coding that junior computer scientists used to do. So I think we're going to see a changed job market, but I'm confident that knowledge of and expertise in computing and artificial intelligence, along with related disciplines, are going to continue to be extremely valuable spaces of study for our students and for those entering the workforce across a whole array of domains.
And when you talk about related disciplines and connectivity, there is concern about these computing schools popping up at universities around the country and that they're siloing computer science majors and from keeping them engaged deeply with other disciplines like the humanities, like social sciences.
We're going to be doing just the opposite. We are committed to this new college being a hub for the whole university, not a silo, not a fortress. There will be no moat around it. Rather, we're going to be building it to make sure that there's significant connectivity. And then also, we look at questions not just about how AI is increasing and growing, but also some of the ethical questions around how do you use AI responsibly, and what does this mean across all disciplines? So I envision that there'll be just as much or more linkage between AI and the humanities, the arts, the sciences, our School of Medicine and Public Health, and we're all very committed to ensuring that the college is built with a focus on those forms of connectivity.
Chancellor Mnuchin, this news comes in a very difficult budget environment, as you know, and departments across campus were asked to reduce their budgets by 5 to 7%, some departments seeing layoffs. So how are you and other campus leaders weighing this decision in the midst of a budget challenge in other areas of the university?
Yeah, thank you for the important question. We're committed to making sure that we can continue to build for our future and that it does not come at the expense of the many strengths all across our university. We'll be moving, obviously, some positions and some budget from Letters and Science to this new College of Computing, but that will come from the parts of the budget that are already going to these areas. And we're also committed to growing philanthropic support and private corporate support to help support the college. So I'm confident that we're going to be able to do this in a way that doesn't detract from the great many incredibly important strengths all across our campus. And it's also very important in times of budget challenge that we continue to make sensible fiscal decisions, but that we also build for our shared future for the sake of our university, our state, our students, and future opportunities.
We're talking with Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin about the new AI college coming to UW-Madison and other updates from campus. You know, around the state, people are concerned about the encroachment of AI, especially when it comes to all of the data centers which are popping up around Wisconsin. There have been protests of these data centers. How are you making the case to Wisconsinites about why the UW needs to make this further investment in AI?
Well, I think AI is touching so many aspects of all of our lives, and that's not going away. We need to assess how we do that and how we do that well, and all of the important issues around questions of sustainability, questions of what kinds of skills do students and the workforce need in order to succeed. But the answer can't be to turn away from these important areas. There's just no question that every major industry is being touched by technology, and AI literacy and expertise are going to be essential for our economic sustainability and our future. So we hope and expect that this new college will help ensure that Wisconsin companies and communities don't get left behind in that digital transformation, but rather that we're ready to face it head on.
So while computer science majors are booming, there are other majors that are shrinking, and UW system administrators are developing this new metric for determining when to cut academic programs. What would you say to people here who are concerned about seeing programs like French or German or Filipino language classes, these programs perhaps going away while the university invests in a new AI college?
So I think it's really important to recognize that we're not just treating artificial intelligence as a panacea or as a plus, but rather as something that's impacting all kinds of things, including possibly even learning languages, learning foreign languages, how we do the arts. We need humanities to be part of our AI infrastructure. You know, university students do make their own decisions about what to study and what to learn, and universities need to be responsive to that. So there are marketplace dimensions to what we do, but we're also not simply a marketplace. We are repositories of knowledge and learning, and we need to recognize that both of those are extremely important. So I actually think that as we think about AI and what it means for our future, that there's a good deal of space for the humanities and the arts and the social sciences, as well as the sciences, to be a very important part of that conversation, of that research, and even modes of study. Critical thinking skills, the ability to write and think, these needs are not going away simply because we have large language models.
What happens after programs get flagged for low enrollment? What will this metric do to such programs?
So the Board of Regents is considering how they're going to think about these issues across the system. We at UW-Madison have been fortunate to be able to make our own internal choices about program development and how we operate. I'm not saying that we're not affected by the possibility of low enrollments anywhere, but I really think that we have so many opportunities to ensure that we are teaching such a big array of majors and programs and of study, and we're going to continue to do exactly that.
International student enrollment is down this year, with 30% fewer international freshman students coming to UW-Madison this fall. How is that affecting the university?
So we did see a real, though modest, decrease in overall international student enrollment. I believe we were down about 500 students overall. We have about, overall, in terms of our undergraduate population, about 3,600 international undergraduates this fall, as opposed to 3,782 the previous year. So there is a decrease, but it is not an enormous decrease. We are really proud of the way that we are a global intellectual community, and that we provide opportunities to students from all across the world, many of whom do end up staying right here and becoming entrepreneurs or making contributions right here in Wisconsin. Others of whom take the Wisconsin values and the Wisconsin idea back to their home country. So we continue to care a lot about having a global community. We want to work to support our international undergraduates. We were pleased that most of the students who wanted to be with us were able to go through the visa process. But we also recognize that at this moment, some of our national policies risk making our global students feel less welcome in our nation, and we think that's too bad.
Chancellor Mnookin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for this opportunity.
That is UW-Madison Chancellor Jennifer Mnookin. We've been talking about challenges facing the university this year and last week's announcement of a new College of Computing and Artificial Intelligence, which is set to launch in July. And for disclosure, Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of UW-Madison.
Coming up, if a Wisconsin business wants to sell stuff overseas, they face high transportation costs. Find out what that means for the state's economic well-being.
It's a lot less expensive to ship from Chicago to China than it is to ship from our place in Wisconsin down to Chicago. And it's a huge handicap for our state, these extra shipping costs.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Over the past year, the Trump administration has radically changed the immigration landscape in the United States. As federal agents have moved into cities around the country, immigration detentions have hit record highs.
Meanwhile, Wisconsin's immigration attorneys are feeling strained as they try to keep up with the demand. Bridget Bowden has more.
On a recent Friday afternoon, volunteers signed in a church basement in Madison for their shift at the Community Immigration Law Center's legal clinic.
So if you could put your name, your language, and whether you're competent to translate for the attorneys.
The center is a nonprofit that provides lawyers for people at risk of deportation free of charge. They've run the clinic since 2009. But in the last year, giving people legal advice has gotten a lot more complicated, says attorney Natalia Lusak.
Very frequently it happens that I am at one of these community clinics that we have and will provide advice, and a few hours later it's already incorrect. The policy has changed, something has changed, and the information I gave is stale.
Lusak says that's largely thanks to immigration policy changes made by the Trump administration. The president began his second term by signing a slew of immigration-related executive orders. Since then, the administration has continued implementing changes, including most recently pausing pending green card and citizenship applications for immigrants from 19 countries.
And so there's always a change when there's a new administration, but this has certainly been really drastic. The number of policy changes, sort of large scale, and even with the minutiae of how you file things, how you pay fees, the forms that you're completing have all changed since the beginning of the year.
The changes have made it difficult for Lusak and other immigration attorneys to offer the best legal advice at any given moment. She says not only do they have to know the new policies, but also any challenges to those policies.
Keeping track of various court cases across the country to see kind of what their status is in terms of whether there's an injunction that's preventing the policy from going to place or whether it's lifted or things like that.
Simon Hankinson is a research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says the flurry of policy changes has been difficult to keep up with, but he believes it's a needed correction from the number of people living in the country without legal status reaching record highs during the Biden years.
I think if we'd never had that initial massive change, then we wouldn't have had to have the reaction in response.
Department of Homeland Security officials have credited the changes for a dramatic uptick in deportations. And as immigration detentions have hit record highs this year, lawyers say fear has too. La Crosse attorney Chuck Barron says even people with legal status are scared. He estimates that he's done more naturalization cases this year than in the last 2 or 3 years combined.
Now people who've been relatively comfortable and have raised families and have had careers in the United States with a green card are like, I don't know if this is safe anymore.
Community Immigration Law Center legal director Aisa Olivares says some anxiety stems from physically going to hearings as authorities have ramped up arrests in courthouses. There is no immigration court in Wisconsin, so nearly all of the center's cases go through the court in Chicago, where there's been a heavy ICE presence.
I've been meeting with clients this week who have upcoming hearings who are just very nervous about what it means to travel to Chicago, what it means to present their court case, which is their right, in Chicago, and will I be detained? And I can't guarantee that.
As they navigate the changing landscape, Olivares says the center's lawyers are still having some success in court, but she says it's also taken a toll.
We do this work because it is important to us. Due process is important to us. Justice is important to us. But when those things are starting to be eroded by the system itself and we're up against this system, it's really difficult.
And just about a year into Trump's second term, they don't expect the demand for their services to lessen anytime soon. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin farmers and manufacturers ship their products all over the world. Lumber, soybeans, dairy products, and machinery are sold to people in China, Germany, Canada, and all points in between.
Exporting products can be especially expensive for producers in the state. One of our next guests says it costs him more to ship his lumber to Chicago than it does to ship it from Chicago to China.
Larry Krieger is co-owner and vice president of Krieger Lumber in Valders in northeastern Wisconsin. The company sells hardwood lumber. And John Varda is an attorney who represents the Lake States Shippers Association. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
And Larry, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Larry, let's start with you because you actually were the inspiration for this conversation. We talked to you about tariffs a couple few months back. And after you mentioned to us that shipping costs are a problem for your company and actually a big problem for exports in Wisconsin. What are you running into? What kind of problems, what kind of hurdles are there for you to export your product?
Sure. The state of Wisconsin used to have a lot more rail service than it has now. And most products coming any long distance come in these metal shipping containers. And those shipping containers, if they're going a long distance, go along a lot of that distance via rail. And there's really only one spot in our entire state to bring these metal containers by rail into our state. And that's up in Chippewa Falls, way in the northwest corner of the state. Unfortunately, a great deal of the manufacturing and population of our state is over on the eastern part of the state. And anyone who produces or manufactures in the eastern part of the state typically have to take these shipping containers and truck them out of state to get them on the railroad, namely to the Chicago area, because there are no other good rail loading sites in the state of Wisconsin.
And you mentioned to our producer, Larry, and I want to make sure you have this right. You want to ship something from Valders, from eastern Wisconsin to, say, China. It's going to cost you more to get from your workplace to Chicago with that good than it does to take it from Chicago all the way to China. Do I have that right?
You do have that correct, and it's absolutely crazy, and it's a huge handicap for our state is these extra shipping costs. So I will pay often $1,800 or so to bring a container, only shipping containers, from the Chicago area up to our sawmill, roughly an hour and a half, 3 hours north of Chicago. And I can get that same shipping container from Chicago area to China for about, $900. So it's a lot less expensive to ship from Chicago to China than it is to ship from our place in Wisconsin down to Chicago because of the huge cost to dray these shipping containers by truck.
Now, John, you've been watching this issue for a long time as you represent the Great Lakes Shippers Association. What has happened in Wisconsin that makes it so hard for people like Larry and others to get those containers, get their products on those containers, and connect them with the global seafaring trade?
Well, over a number of years, in the late 80s and into the 90s, we sort of got disconnected from the national rail network in terms of movement of containers. For a while, from early 90s through 2003 or so, Wisconsin Central Railroad did operate a local intermodal service between Green Bay and central Wisconsin on the one hand and Chicago. Operation took like 60,000 trucks or trailers per year off the highway. The biggest customer was Schneider National, a motor carrier.
And now that's all gone? That's what happened that said, okay, it's no longer viable to keep that open there?
Well, when Canadian National took over Wisconsin Central in 2001, about a year later, so a year or so later, September 2003, CN decided we don't want that short haul service. It's taking up capacity on their line. We're not making enough money off of it. And it was simply terminated, which was the only intermodal operation of any significance. There had been some from Milwaukee that was with the Canadian Pacific, but pretty much, Larry has it correct, the only real operational intermodal terminal in Wisconsin is in the Chippewa Falls area.
And if I have that correct, John, that's mostly serving Menards?
Yes, that was what they call the anchor tenant. Menards was importing, and the balance for export was mainly grain, local agricultural products.
All right, Larry, suppose I'm a customer in Asia and I'm looking to buy some American hardwood like you provide. What kind of conversations am I having with you about shipping costs? What does that go like? Who ends up paying extra, or do they go elsewhere if those costs are there?
Sure. We do ship to a number of different places in Asia. A lot of other Wisconsin producers do. And when I talk to my customer and they're arranging the shipping of those containers to buy our product, they keep asking me, why is it so expensive to buy product and ship it out of Wisconsin? And I say, well, to be honest, the real reason is most of our shipping containers have to be trucked out of our great state of Wisconsin and down to Wisconsin in order to get on the railroad. And those extra costs are added on to the transportation, and sometimes it makes us less competitive. And if I'm selling something for a buck a foot, say, and it costs me 20 cents a foot to ship it, and the customer can buy it somewhere else for 10 cents a foot transportation, they're gonna buy their products somewhere other than in Wisconsin. And that's because we have these extra transportation costs. And we really should think about a way to fix this.
So, Larry, in that case, do you lose the sale or do you eat that transportation cost to keep the sale?
Usually I eat the transportation costs. We have to sell our Wisconsin product for a lower price because we have higher transportation costs.
And how much of your business is international versus domestic or Canada-Mexico?
Oh, I'd say we do about 30% international sales.
We are talking about transportation of goods out of Wisconsin for export overseas and what's been called a black hole by some of service for that kind of shipping. We got Larry Krieger with us with Krieger Lumber in Valders, Wisconsin, and John Varda, who represents the Lake States Shippers Association. John, what would it take to get an intermodal system in here where people like Larry could get their stuff right into a container, right on a train, and get it to an ocean?
Well, there's some exciting potential news on the horizon in 2026. Union Pacific has proposed to merge with Norfolk Southern, providing the first really transcontinental, coast-to-coast, Class 1 railroad. They think there are many advantages of it, but one of the advantages we see is that Union Pacific does serve portions of Wisconsin and could serve more portions of Wisconsin. And what that opportunity results in, particularly for the intermodal containers, is if you have a single line haul, and that can be virtual single line, you can start out with a terminal railroad that takes care of the first mile, last mile, but then you connect. If the UP merger goes through, you'd connect with Union Pacific, and you could go either to the West Coast or the East Coast or the Gulf Coast, single line intermodal. Intermodal is very much advantaged if you can have that kind of single line service and avoid the kind of dray miles to and from the intermodal terminal that Larry's been talking about.
Now, John, if I'm a big rail line, maybe I just merged and I'm considering, hey, do I open something like this in Wisconsin? Is there a thought that I might look and say, hey, but Chicago's really close and it has all the infrastructure there in place. Is it worth putting the money into developing the infrastructure to do this stuff in Wisconsin? Is it a slam dunk that they'd want to do that?
There is a good deal of that infrastructure already present in Wisconsin. There are some gaps because of abandonments and disconnections that occurred in the 90s and early 2000. But there is money, public funding available, grant monies to assist in restoring that type of infrastructure.
All right, Larry, suppose this happened and you could truck your wood instead of to Chicago to, I don't know, I'm looking at the map, Manitowoc or the Fox Cities, wherever this line would run through. What would that mean for your business?
Well, number one, it would help make Wisconsin more competitive. Business is tough right now. There's a lot of tariffs and trade tensions in general, but people are still buying some products. And if we could make our transportation costs for Wisconsin products less expensive, we would outcompete our neighbors, and that would really help sales and production here in Wisconsin. There are a number of opportunities, I think, for a Class 1 railroad to make some money by giving service directly here in Wisconsin onto the railroad. When you load containers, those shipping containers, right on the railroad here in Wisconsin, you don't have to pay overweight truck permits to go down to Chicago to haul those containers. You can put them right on the rail here in Wisconsin and create jobs here in Wisconsin and save a bunch of money and sell more product.
And John, you mentioned something earlier. This isn't necessarily just about Wisconsin's economy and jobs and producers. You mentioned road traffic. Is there really a big difference to be made if we're shipping a lot of this stuff by train versus trucking it down to Chicago to where, you know, people on the highways are going to notice a difference?
Well, you have to take a fairly dramatic number of vehicles to make a difference on the highway, but you reduce congestion almost immediately. The railroad industry, on the other hand, is capital intensive and is benefited most by increasing its market share. Where is it going to get that market share? Take it off the highway. Increasing that market share will reduce highway congestion. It will extend the useful life of our interstate system, for example, in terms of providing a level of service acceptable to motorists and increasing numbers of motorists without having to add that extra lane.
Now, Larry, you heard what John was talking about earlier, the possible railroad merger and that merged entity possibly coming into Wisconsin. I'm guessing that's something you're following yourself. Are you hopeful? Do you think that there is a reasonable chance that this could happen in the next couple of few years?
I've never had any good luck trying to predict what a large railroad will or will not do. But I do know their markets have changed quite a bit in the last few years. The Class One railroads used to rely a lot on hauling coal in and around the country for burning, for making electricity. A lot of places don't burn coal anymore, so they don't have that business. There's also been a lot of trade tension with Canada and Mexico, so a lot of the rail cars they used to use to haul product aren't being used anymore. So some of these big railroads are looking for new business. And if they can give a new rail service for shipping our Wisconsin containers, it would give them new additional business right here in Wisconsin. Tens of thousands of containers of Wisconsin product could be shipped, and it would take them off the road. It would save our Wisconsin shippers a bunch of money. It would really help our state. So I'm kind of optimistic because I think this is an opportunity for them to get some new business and make some money here in Wisconsin.
We'll leave it there. Larry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And John, thanks for being with us.
Very nice. Appreciate it.
John Varda is an attorney who represents the Lake States Shippers Association. And Larry Krieger is co-owner and vice president of Krieger Lumber in Valders. They talked with us about exports and high shipping costs for Wisconsin businesses that want to sell their products overseas.
Coming up, a community group tries to solve sediment problems in Lake Pepin in western Wisconsin. Find out why they feel such a strong connection to the lake.
I've lived on both sides of the lake. I farmed on both sides of the lake. I was married on top of Maiden Rock Bluff in the dead cold of winter, looking out over the frozen lake. The lake is part of me.
That's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Along the Mississippi River, southwest of Eau Claire, Lake Pepin is home to a diverse ecosystem, and it has a long history of recreation and transportation for its surrounding communities in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Plus, it's known as the birthplace of water skiing.
But the lake is under threat by a growing accumulation of sediment that comes from upstream and then settles in the lake.
That's lowering the water level in some areas, leading to boat groundings and ecological degradation, and threatening the future of Lake Pepin.
A local nonprofit group is working to reduce that sediment load and promote restoration efforts for the shrinking body of water. Michael Anderson is executive director of the Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
So for people who are not familiar with the area, can you tell us a little bit about the geography of Lake Pepin? It's a lake. It's also part of the Mississippi River.
We are a little bit of both here. Lake Pepin is sandwiched in between the bluffs on the Wisconsin side and the Minnesota side. We are a riverine lake, so we are part of the Mississippi River, but we're also a lake. We're the largest natural forming lake on the entire Mississippi River. We're all 22 miles long of us. We're a big lake that encompasses a lot of communities on both sides of the river.
Before we get into some of the problems you're trying to tackle there, I want to hear a little bit about the history of the Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance. How did people in that area come together to tackle some of the concerns we're going to talk about?
So the origins of the alliance go back to about 2009, 2010, when really citizens, the public that was living, that lives around the lake, started to really see the infilling at the head of the lake, or the most upstream portion of the lake. So they were seeing islands form where there never was an island, or sandbars continue to grow, favorite fishing spots become devoid of fish, boat groundings, things like that. So that's what triggered the, okay, what is going on here? What do we need to look at? How is this, a normal thing, or is this a problem? And what can we do about it if it is?
What is causing that to happen? I think the key word here we need to talk about is sediment. Why are we seeing this sediment forming to start at the northern reaches of the lake?
That is the key thing here, sediments. We get tons of sediment coming into Lake Pepin from the Mississippi River upstream of us, and in particular from the Minnesota River. Somewhere about 80% or so of the sediment that comes to Lake Pepin originates from the Minnesota River. And all of that washes down. Once it gets to the lake where it gets wider, the sediment spreads and settles out and slows down, drops out at the head of the lake. So that sediment that we're seeing is coming from agricultural spaces. It's coming from, to a lesser degree, but from urban runoff and a lot of what is termed near channel sources. So those areas that are close to the channel of a stream or a river that are eroding. And we get a lot of our sediment has been fingerprinted back to those locations.
Right. People might think, oh, well, a river is going to have sediment. Of course, it's a natural process, but there's more going on here. A lot of this, the bulk of this change sounds like it's human caused. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. Absolutely. It's worth saying that Lake Pepin used to start before people lived here, before this area was settled, started further upstream, and it has gradually filled in over the millennia. And if left untouched, we're looking at maybe 4,000 years or so, 3,500 years, where it would just naturally accumulate sedimentation. Now that we have introduced modern agriculture to the landscape, we've really ratcheted that up, and the sedimentation is filling in the lake 10 times faster than it ever would have. So we're looking at a lifespan of Lake Pepin of somewhere in the 350-year range, if everything holds stable to what we're doing right now.
But it sounds like you're already feeling the impact. What are some of the uses of the lake? You were starting to touch on this already. What are some of the things that people like to do on the lake for fun or economic reasons or whatever that, hey, this sediment is already interfering with?
Yeah, fishing and waterfowl hunting and boating are some huge recreation uses of the lake. There are significant boat groundings that happen where people aren't aware of a specific area. We get a lot of people who visit the lake, and when they're boating around in what seems like it should be deep areas, is just maybe 2 or 3 feet deep, and all of a sudden your boat is stuck on a sandbar or one of the muddier areas in the river or of the lake because of that sedimentation. So that's some of like the real drastic effects that you feel if you're here on the lake. If you fish or if you waterfowl hunt, places that you may have gone 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or even, you know, dated back to generations before you where they were hunting or fishing, some of those places just, you can't get there anymore. They're either too shallow or in some cases they're just land and there's no going there to fish or to hunt like people used to.
Now that's human uses. What kind of ecological concerns are there with this sediment buildup?
Having this much sediment, we're really reducing the capacity for fish and waterfowl in areas where this sediment is accumulating. Once you start to get that buildup of fine sediment, you can get it to resuspend into the water column. So it makes a really cloudy, muddy water column. So you can't really see in it. Plants, aquatic vegetation then won't grow. And once you start to lose your aquatic vegetation, you can lose the fish that require that for habitat and for food. and you're therefore going to lose waterfowl for similar reasons. So the ducks, the fish really, really feel the pinch of sedimentation here at the head of the lake.
We are talking about Lake Pepin on the Mississippi River on the Minnesota-Wisconsin border, and problems for human use, for ecological causes as well, from sediment. Michael Anderson is with us with the Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance. Okay, let's start with your efforts to cut down on the amount of sediment coming in the first place. What did those efforts look like? What would it take to stop new sediment from coming in?
That is a phenomenal question, and there are organizations aplenty and agencies aplenty that are trying to solve sedimentation entering the Minnesota River, the Mississippi River, and Lake Pepin. Things that we can do to reduce the sediment are activities that slow the flow of water. And what I mean by that is we want to keep water on the land longer. So if we can create different types of storage features of water, and some of those are as simple and as tried and true as restoring wetlands, that holds water on the landscape. And if we're holding water on the landscape, not only are we capturing whatever sediment may have been in that, but we now have less erosive potential in the river itself. Other than wetlands, there are some other features that other erosion control measures that can be implemented in farm fields and agricultural spaces that will slow water, will keep it on the land longer, and in ways that don't harm crops either.
I usually hear things like cover crops or border plantings, things like that. Is that the sort of thing we're talking about that farmers could do?
That is absolutely one of the things farmer can do is are some of the growing practices. So cover crops is a great one. They not only hold the soil in place, they will hold nutrients in place and they'll hold water on the land. So in that same vein, when we look at perennial crops, things that stay in the year more than, you know, just for the growing season. So whether that's hay ground or crops like kernza is a crop that's similar to wheat and growing in traction and popularity, and a lot of effort is behind that from both sides of the border here. Minnesota and Wisconsin are putting a lot of effort into figuring out how farmers can grow kernza better. It has such huge potential for our water. So yeah, that's some of the farmer growing, the things farmers can grow. Farmers also can do things that fall under the umbrella of reduced tillage. So that would mean no-till agriculture, strip-till agriculture, things that don't disturb the soil column and we don't break it up as much. When we have a more intact soil structure, that can hold more water and more nutrients on the land. So those are two common things that farmers do and that we advocate for. And some of the other things that people, landowners can do and farmers can do, or they can build structures on their land that will, like I said earlier, hold the water, like some sort of physical structure. Some of them, they don't always have amazing names, but a water and sediment control basin is one of them, where they're often on a field edge or in really erosive areas of fields. They capture water, they let it slowly release, and at the same time that captures the sediment. So these are some of the strong techniques that we know work and we are pushing for, advocating for, as well as a host of other agencies too.
All right. That's the sediment coming in, the sediment that's already there. What can you do about that?
The sediment that's already in the lake?
Yeah.
One great example of what you can do is a ongoing, nearly completed project in Bay City on Lake Pepin. It's colloquially called the Bay City Restoration Project, but its official name is the Upper Pool 4 Habitat Restoration Project, located within the Pierce County Islands complex here on the Mississippi River. That project is building islands and it's digging out dredging out overwintering pools, they're called. So areas where fish can congregate in the winter as well as year round, that is using that fine sediment. So that sediment that may have come from a farm field up the Minnesota River Valley, it's getting dredged out. It's getting placed on top of these islands that were created. And that is then going to be used as the growing structure, the growing medium for plants, for trees, for everything that's there. So that's one of the things we can do with that excess sediment that we have here at the head of the lake. We can use it in these restoration projects.
That sounds kind of labor intensive and maybe expensive. Who's covering the costs? Who's making this happen?
You're right on both points, labor intensive and expensive. So this project here near Bay City, we are in the low $20 million project, and it is mostly federally funded with a large part coming also from the state of Wisconsin. So the state of Wisconsin put in over $3 million to get this project going, as well as the state of Minnesota, through one of their granting programs, put in $750,000, and that as well as some local partners and cities that put in money in, like Bay City and Stockholm and Red Wing, they all realized the value that this project would have. Everyone pulled their money, and that then triggered the federal government to release more money to be able to do this project. So these are projects that happen up and down the river. There has been some successful projects near La Crosse, Wisconsin as well, in Pool 7 and 8, that are building islands, planting on those islands, that reduces not only the you're dredging out sediment that's in the water, but you are creating habitat when you dig out those pools, habitat for fish, habitat for waterfall, and for more plants to grow, and kind of create a positive feedback loop where we're kickstarting the natural processes again.
Now, Michael, on a personal note, you obviously are committed to Lake Pepin, and I understand you've lived on the Minnesota and Wisconsin sides of it over the years. What is it that's special to you about Lake Pepin?
Well, for me, it feels part of me. I've lived on both sides of the lake. I've farmed on both sides of the lake. I was married on top of Maiden Rock Bluff in the dead cold of winter, looking out over the frozen lake. The lake is part of me. And for those that live around it know exactly what that means. Not seeing the lake in a day can be hard. I remember a good friend of mine who lives over in Stockholm, they used to farm kind of right down near the water, and they could see the lake every day. They then moved their farm to the top of the bluff, and I remember her telling me how much she missed just seeing the lake on a daily basis, that she got to a point where she climbed one of the trees on her property so she could see the lake from where they were on top of the bluff. Like, it just becomes a part of you, if that makes sense.
It does. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Anderson is Executive Director of the Lake Pepin Legacy Alliance. He was with us today to share his organization's efforts to reduce sediment buildup that threatens transportation, recreation, and the ecosystem on Lake Pepin along the Mississippi River.
In Wausau, the County Parks Department started work on creating the downtown ice rink last week, and some communities around the state are seeing some significant snowpack now. And Rob, I saw my neighbor walk by with a pair of cross-country skis slung over their shoulder the other day, and that caused me to find my own in the garage.
We want to know, as recent snowfalls and chilly temperatures stick around, how does that factor into your outdoor hobbies? Are you a cross-country skier or snowmobiler? How do you feel about the trails at this point in the winter? Maybe you have some snowshoes you like to put on and go for a winter hike, or are you getting ready for ice fishing season?
What outdoor pursuits have you been able to start doing again in your corner of Wisconsin, and how does it make you feel?
Give us your personal snow and winter report, and we'd love to share it in a future program. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Joe Tarr, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.